You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
It happened in here. She was sitting right here. He could have seen us through this window. Standing on the lawn, he could have seen inside. You must think me a very sinister doctor. I do have a permit.
Seems to me you're just plain scared.
Yes. Yeah, I am. I met him 15 years ago. I was told there was nothing left. No reason, no conscience, no understanding, and even the most rudimentary sense of life or death, of good or evil, right or wrong. I met this 6-year-old child with this blank, pale, emotionless face and the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up, because I realized that what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil.
What do we do?
He's been here once tonight. I think he'll come back. I'm going to wait for him.
Hello and welcome to a very spooky edition of the 602 Club. I hope you are glad to be here, because I am glad to be here, and I want to introduce my guest host today, the wonderful and accomplished John Mills, who has talked me into watching a movie that's quite scary.
Yes. Yes. I've spent 15 years keeping you locked up trying to watch this film. And you finally
well,
did.
I have escaped in a station wagon, and now I'm ready to talk about it.
Not just any station wagon, a 1978 Ford LTD, which I know for a fact is one of the toughest cars ever created in history, because a friend of mine
really
owned one, and the thing was...
And you put that through hell, didn't you?
We called it the War Wagon. Thing was unstoppable. No, seriously. Like, he spun out one time, and he actually hammered the fender back into shape, like with a hammer.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And they just put it back on and kept driving. So it's good.
Yeah, they don't make them like that anymore.
They do not, because they care about gas mileage. So
this is true. Yeah. You know, when gas isn't like 48 cents a gallon, you really do care.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, well, welcome to the 602 Club. I hope everybody is excited to be here. And especially as you're listening to us when it drops, it's going to be Halloween 2018. And that is exactly what we are going to be talking about. Now, I got to preface that by saying this is Halloween 1978. There's a brand new movie, which is Halloween 2018.
Which is
different films.
Which is not to be confused with Halloween, which came out in 2007 and was directed by Rob Zombie.
So good. Why? Just name it something different.
You know, that's actually a really good question. Is we're in the era of Halloween, you know, like shouldn't it be like Halloween colon something something something, right? Like, it's so wild that the sequel, the newest sequel, has the same title as the original. Like, it's off-putting in a sense.
It is very off-putting, because I mean, even like when you're just searching for it, like an IMDb or whatever, and you got to go choose, oh, which Halloween do I want, instead of like being, it's Halloween. Like, I am kind of surprised the new one isn't like Halloween colon Michael's Revenge or something, you know?
Right, yeah. No, even when the first time they tried to, well, I mean, technically it was the second time, but the first time it's acknowledged that they tried to completely reboot the series, Halloween H2O 20 years later. There weren't enough colons in that movie. It was literally Halloween H2O 20 years later on screen.
Are you sure there weren't like a lot of colons like laying around the floor that had been like carved out or something?
I'm pretty sure somebody evacuated one at some point, but you know.
Oh, gosh. Well, before we get going completely here and forget to mention, you can find us all over the place here at the 602 Club. We're on iTunes at itunes.com/TrekFM with all the other Trek FM shows. While you're over there, you know, hit us up with a star rating and review. But you can find us all over the place, wherever you get your podcasts. We're even in Spotify, so make sure you check us out there. Any place you can give us a star rating and review helps, but specifically on iTunes. It's really the best place to help out the show grow. So 4 years going strong. Make sure you help us out in that way, and I'll call you out in the show if you give us a star rating and review, a written review. Then I can read it on the show, and thank you for that. You can find us on Twitter, Trek FM, Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. There is a listeners-only discussion group, which you can find on Facebook, called the Babel Conference. If you're on Facebook, type Babel into the search field, or if you're on our website at trek.fm, any of the show pages, hit discussion on the menu bar, and that would bring you over there. And then last but not least, if you want to send an email, which I love getting emails, so, you know, don't get enough emails. So I don't know why people don't send the new snail mail anymore, but go over to the trek.fm/contact, choose a show, choose the 602 Club, and then that message will come to me and any host that's on that week, and we can talk to you about whatever it is that you would like to talk about. Halloween, 1978. John, I wanted to ask you, because this is a movie that I know that you really, really like, and it's been a movie that's had a big impact for you as a film fan and for a very long time. And so I kind of wanted to ask you about your first experience, your first time with watching Halloween. And I really wanted to hear from you, what is it that you love about this film specifically?
The first time I encountered this, my recollection is that I had come home from trick-or-treating. And it was on TV, and I was just sitting in the family room watching it on an old little, probably the TV screen was like a 9-inch Zenith or something like that. And
classic.
Yeah, just watching it, pan and scan, not even letterboxed. Just the network version, and just sitting there watching it. And my recollection, although this can't possibly be correct, but my recollection is that I changed channels at one point and caught either the entirety of or part of Halloween 2 that same night, or maybe I turned back or something, because my first memory of seeing these, you know, Halloween and Halloween 2 are at this point conflated into one event. And I instantly became somewhat obsessed with it. As a matter of fact, when I took my cousins out trick-or-treating, I actually dressed up as Michael Myers with a legit Don Post Studios Michael Myers recreation mask. So in a sense, Michael Myers has always been the boogeyman to me, just because it's just indelibly, you know, when I'm in a dark room or I'm turning my back on a dark basement or something, I don't see Jason. I don't think of Freddy. I think of that just, you know, implacable William Shatner face staring back at me.
So you think of the attack of the mouth breather. That's what scares you.
Well, it ruins any movie theater experience, that's for sure. But bum. But yeah, you know, like it's one of those things where just that idea. I mean, I grew up in the sticks. And so, you know, it was really, first suburbs, then sticks. And so it very much spoke to that idea of like being out somewhere where, you know, you didn't really know your neighbors too well. And, you know, later on, I didn't have many neighbors. And just that idea of like, is somebody out there in the dark, right? Like if I see somebody with a hockey mask, whatever, you know, and somebody in my dreams, I already know, yeah, okay, that ain't going to happen. But like just the idea that there's some psycho out there just staring, just, and I can't read a face and I don't hear a voice. And like, yeah, that's unsettling.
Do you think that Star Trek gets any residuals from this?
No, you know, it's funny. The first time I ever found out that it was a William Shatner mask was actually thanks to The Tonight Show, because William Shatner and Jamie Lee Curtis were on the same Tonight Show episode, and Shatner was on there promoting Star Trek V. And Jamie Lee Curtis looked at him at one point and said, "You know, Michael Myers, that was a Captain Kirk mask." And, you know, in his Shatner way, he was like, "Huh?" And I, like, at that moment, it was like, you know, young me was like, "It's what?" And, like, you know, back then there's no internet. Like, so, you know, you do the hard work of like looking up old Fangoria and Starlog magazines and stuff like, is that true? And it is.
Yeah. That cracked me up. Because there are times when you're, you know, watching the film and you are kind of glued in on his face and you're like, it really just looks like a really white William Shatner looking at you, and it's just creepy.
It just, I guess, I wasn't much of a Star Trek fan growing up, so it that connection didn't exist for me. I can like see it now. There's actually somebody where what they did was they recreated the mask and then they gave it, Shatner's flesh tone. And it's like, oh yeah, spitting image. But just, I think just the step of shaving the hair off and then gluing it back on made it, you know, put it just a little bit off.
No, I mean, because it the rest of it doesn't have that feel, you know, obviously with the hair being different. And for your first time you saw it as a kid, what is it that captured you then as an older person that kind of kept you feeling like this was a movie worth coming back to?
Honestly, this is one of those movies where I don't think I can add anything particularly interesting to the conversation in terms of that, except to say that.
Let me just preface everyone by saying this is the first time I've ever seen it. So I'm asking John this question because I'm a complete noob to this Halloween movie. So I'm just wondering, I don't care if it's anything new. I'm just wondering, you know, what it is that kind of keeps you coming back.
I think it's definitely, the minimalist score, I think, is it's creepy. Like when you're driving around at night and, you know, that music comes on. I think that there is a tremendous discipline in the way that Dean Cundey set up the shots in the film, especially the more iconic ones. The way that this film is lit is unsettling in and of itself. You go back to, you know, the shot of her in tears and Michael slowly revealing in the shadows behind her, and she can't see him, but the audience can. Those sorts of things. I think that there is a rigid discipline to the structure, but I think that really what gives the film its soul, and probably why I've stayed, the thing that I think makes it work the best is Donald Pleasence's performance, because he's the one. I really do think that Loomis is that missing ingredient that all of the imitators missed out on, where you have Loomis as this very reasonable, he's a doctor, he's a psychiatrist, and even he has, thanks to his exposure to Michael, come to no longer try to explain him, but just say he is just pure evil. And to hear a person of science, a person of reason, say, "I got nothing. This person's just pure evil." Like that I think is the soul of the film.
Yeah, I think a lot of the things that you mentioned, or, you know, just for me, the first time was my wife and I watched this last night. We just rented it on iTunes, and luckily I think it's the 4K version that's on iTunes now that's out as well. So
the transfer is approved by Cundey, so I hope so, because it's important to make sure.
So I mean,
that
it looks very good, and in that sense, you know, the presentation, and I think I appreciated, you know, for the things that you mentioned about the filmmaking aspects, you know, the beginning of the movie where he does the point of view, you know, with the kill and everything, which is funny because I was like, wow, he's really ahead of his time with this first person shooter, you know, Because that's what it feels like, is that kind of video game aspect of, you know, you're going around the house and all that, and this that kind of perspective. And then, of course, you know, his first kill as a six-year-old, where, you know, you're just looking through the eye holes of the mask and everything, and it's as if you are in the head of Michael Myers doing this thing, which is very creepy. I mean, it's a good way to start off the film. And then he kind of continues that with a lot of close-up shots with things, so you get that uneasy sense where, because you can't see what's going on in the other, you know, the periphery of your vision for the characters, mm-hmm. And so it does give you, so I think he does a lot of really smart things in that, and I think I can really sense why this movie, I could see why it kind of was, it became a hallmark for the rest of the horror genre, because it created a lot of things that helped create the suspense that he wanted, you know, and that what I really appreciated about the film is that I don't like a lot of blood and gore. That's just not my thing. So what I loved is that he created the suspense in much the same way that Hitchcock creates his suspense, which is leaving you guessing as to when something's going to be revealed, continually kind of holding off until it's that moment where it could catch you off guard. You know, a lot of those kind of things that Hitchcock would do to, you know, freak you out at the right moment. You know, I felt like Carpenter picked up on a lot of that stuff and did it pretty decently here, in the sense of being able to create a suspense without showing you a lot of stuff, which I think is such smart economic filmmaking.
Economic, yeah. This was a really low budget film, and
like what, over 300,000, I think it was
something like that, minuscule amount like that. And I'm glad that you call out the Hitchcock thing, because this is not, even though it spawned the subgenre known as slasher, although that's even arguable in and of itself, because there was a movie called Black Christmas, and of course you blow completely past Texas Chainsaw Massacre and, you know, stuff like that when you get into that conversation, but Halloween was, you know, hugely commercially successful, hit a chord with all the audiences, but it isn't a slasher film. It is a suspense film, and it is done as a tribute to Hitchcock. They didn't like say, "Oh, we're going to make a Hitchcock tribute." They said they wanted to basically make a Hitchcock-esque film, and that's why Sam Loomis even has the name Sam Loomis, is it's an homage to Psycho.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, that's the kind of thing that works for me. And in many ways, I saw, you know, the same kind of aspects that John Krasinski used in Quiet Place, mm-hmm. in that sense of, like, you're creating suspense by not showing too much, but you're setting up the situations so that you're on the edge of your seat as, oh, when is that going to come into play? Oh, that's not going to be good, you know? Like, the whole part where her friend is doing her laundry and you keep wondering if and when Michael's going to attack her because he's there,
yeah.
And you know he's there, but she doesn't know it kind of reminded me of the same way in which John Krasinski set up the nail, you know, mm-hmm. when is somebody's going to step on that one, you know, and it's that thing where it's just there and you know something's going to happen, you just don't know when it's going to happen, and that moment that it does, it releases that suspense. But he's very, you know, Carpenter, again, I feel like, does that here in the film where, and then there are times when you think something's going to happen and it doesn't quite yet, so you let your guard down a little bit, and then it starts all back up again, and that's usually where he kind of gets you. So I felt like I can totally see the way in which this film kind of becomes a benchmark for people wanting to do this type of thing. And like we talked a little bit, we talked a lot before the beginning of the show because we were just catching up and talking about the film and everything. But then it people kind of take this mold and then run with it in the sense that they turn it into something else,
yeah.
Other than what this film actually is, which I personally enjoy a film more like this than I do something where it's just people getting bloods and guts and all that kind of stuff all over the place. It's like, you know.
Yeah, and that's even the thing that's, you know, its most famous imitator is Friday the 13th. And you can see even with that first one, there's some attempt to copy this template a little more closely than it turned into. Because Friday the 13th was the mass produced one. It's the, you know, and it's the one that sort of just derailed the evolution of the entire subgenre, honestly. But in terms of setting up the tension, I, you know, the fact that you have a killer that has a face that you can see, that, to get back to your point, in the beginning of the film, you're essentially put inside Michael's head and you're trying to, you don't want to do this. You don't, what's going on? Stop this. I, you know, like, you are the most uncomfortable spectator in the world. And then you've gotten that, that intimate moment with him and you still don't understand him. And then you have other moments, whether it's an over the shoulder shot or his face in the window, where you still don't understand why. Like, it, that's just reinforced through the whole thing. And it, you know, it, even up to and including his reasoning is the reasoning of a psychopath, where it is, there's some sort of reason here, but God help us if we can try to figure it out. It's just, you don't know how his mind is working.
Yeah, and I really, I appreciated that as well about the film, because I think, you know, on top of the thing that he creates with the suspense is the fact that, like you said, is that Loomis, you know, talks about this Michael Myers, and he says, look, I couldn't figure out this person until I realize it's, there is nothing there to figure out other than that this is evil.
Right.
And I actually really appreciated that, because, you know, I feel like, you know, we got to that place where we're trying to deconstruct all of our villains and everything. And but that there, this movie, I think it flows with the rest of human history, which is that we know that there is evil out there. And when we see it in something like this, we know it instinctively. There's, we don't have to have it, you know, broken down. It's just, it is evil, and anybody who would want to just wantonly kill people for no other reason than just to kill them is evil, and we need to, it's okay to call out evil for what it is. And so I really appreciated that this film doesn't try to do the thing that so many films will try to do later on, which is try to give you some sort of insight and as to why and rationalize it or anything like that, because that's where it's actually what you're talking about. Why do we want to rationalize psychopaths? Right. That's not a good thing.
Well, I mean, there's just no chance that, you know, a psychopath has reason but no empathy. And that is something that right. An average human being can't do. I mean, it is something where this film also comes into play during a time when awareness of serial killers is coming to the forefront. You've got going on, the Summer of Sam was 77, if I recall correctly. And you have, you know, Gacy and Bundy's about to break into the national consciousness and everything. And so there's very much an underlying subconscious tension that exists in society, because we're starting to become more familiar with the fact that it's more common than we would like to realize that there are people kind of like Michael Myers out there, people we're never going to be able to understand or reason with. And, you know, even, you know, in Psycho, you know, Norman's based on a real guy, but people weren't really aware, like, that it wasn't quite the national news about Ed Gein, but when you get into the 70s, it's becoming national news that these types of people are out there and operating. And so people are much more aware of this phenomenon. And I think that that's why this works as an homage to Psycho, is because that's based on a real guy who was like that. And so it, you know, it calls to mind just something that is culturally just part and parcel of our awareness now.
And it's it is something that's interesting to me, just because, I guess I have a question then for you, you know, when talking about that, why do you think it is that we enjoy that people, and put it this way, that people enjoy these type of films when it is this this visceral evil. And yet, specifically like in this movie, you know, Michael doesn't die, he gets away. You know, so what is it about us as a people that wants to kind of see that? Like, it seems very strange to me.
Okay, and you're going to be sick of this. I don't know if I've used this anywhere, like when we've recorded before, but you've heard me say this to you about the roller coaster principle. Why do I go on a roller coaster? I go on a roller coaster because I'm strapped in and my conscious, rational mind knows that it is in the financial best interest of this theme park to ensure that I survive this experience. But the tiny lizard brain inside my skull, buried deep down there, is being scared to death doing something that every survival instinct in my soul says, what, don't do this. You don't belong 200 feet in the air. What are you doing, stupid? And so you get that conflicting adrenaline rush. I don't think that there's a desire to celebrate. I mean, Freddy Krueger gets into this uncomfortable gray area where there is this sort of celebration of the anti-hero killer sort of thing, which is really weird. That's a whole other topic. But like, I think that these sorts of things are very key. Like any horror story that kids have embraced over time, and I think especially in the teenage years, you're becoming much more conscious of mortality, and so this is a way to sort of exercise that that tension, and not exercise like, you know, free weights, but like exorcise, like expunge that tension that sort of lays underneath. I confronted it, I survived it, I got out, and I think that the power of the ending in this film is specifically the fact, I don't think there ever should have been a sequel at all. I think that the new sequel overriding the whole series and becoming the one true sequel to this is good. Like, it's a good makeup move. But I don't think there ever should have been a sequel to this because the ending is specifically structured like the best urban legends, the story of Hook Hand, the story of the phone call coming from upstairs, those sorts of things. We tell ourselves these stories because they give us the opportunity to indulge in that fear that we're all carrying around all the time. Is, you know, when I get in the car to drive to work, am I coming home? Right? That's there. And these movies give you the opportunity to, you know, work with that and make it through that.
So you're saying that horror movies are basically just a collective worst case scenario?
I guess, you know, I mean, I think that it's, you know, you can argue till you're blue in the face about, you know, where the state of horror now, the state of horror then, is it really different? Those sorts of things. But yeah, I think that it's we're all raised by parents that are trying to keep us safe. They said, don't go. Oh, I don't want you going off on that trip. I don't want you doing those things. And so it sort of indulges that more childish aspect too, I guess.
Right.
It's interesting to me because our experience are vastly different. You know, you having seen this, grown up with it, you love it still. And, you know, my experience just seeing it last night. And you talked about, you know, for you, the boogeyman is Michael Myers. But I will be honest that I did not find this movie scary at all. Like, there wasn't anything scary in it. I wasn't scared. It doesn't give me nightmares. It actually made me laugh for most of it because of the things that were happening in it. So it's just interesting to me because there is such a different experience that we have in our viewings of the film and the villain. And so for me, this was kind of much more of a, it felt like much more like an academic experience of like, okay, I'm going to watch this and see like what it is that everybody talks about with this film. And I can like recognize some of the technological things, but the actual experience of the, like the what it's going for, the idea of horror, to me, it's not horrific. It's kind of silly.
Let me ask you this though.
Sure.
Honest question. What were your viewing conditions? Under what conditions did you watch this? Were you?
I mean, I just sit next to my wife. We only have one light on when we watch a movie because it's the one that doesn't shine on the TV. It's not very. I mean, it's not super bright.
But I mean, were there any other distractions? Were you guys talking during the film? I mean, because and the reason I ask that is because it, just like a campfire story, the setting sets the stage for how you're going to experience it, right?
Right. No, I mean, I get what you're saying, but I mean, I don't know if I would personally be scared of this movie ever. At this point in my life, watching it, I'm not. There wasn't anything, and I think part of it and is just that there wasn't anything in it that was like really surprising that really made me startle. You know, for the most part, there are a couple little moments where I was like, oh. You know, like it, you know, gets you that, like, you know, but they're just, it wasn't scary. And, you know, like I tend to be somebody who it's easy to have my imagination start running and freak myself out. Right. Like that's just me as a person. So, but this movie, I didn't have any problem going to bed last night or going right to sleep. You know, it wasn't like it kept me up or, you know, anything like that. So
do you
it's
think
just,
that,
it is interesting to me.
Do you think that the anticipation, people talking about it so much and the foreknowledge of the respect and reputation played into your reaction?
That's a good question. And I don't know. I don't know if I could give you an honest answer because it's such a movie that, you know, is kind of like, you know, like people talk about Halloween, but at the same time, I think part of the answer I could give is that I'm not a horror person. I don't enjoy these type of movies for the most part, but there are certain things that I have enjoyed recently that made me think maybe this would be something I would like. You described it as more of a Hitchcock film, which the parts of that that I think worked, I enjoyed, and I liked that. And the fact that it kind of was more of a film in the lines of like a Hitchcock or a, you know, A Quiet Place, where it is more about this suspense, I liked all of that more. But it wasn't anything like for Michael Myers to be like you described. For you, he's the boogeyman. For me, he's just it was quite laughable. And I think part of it was just that the scenes where Michael keeps getting like stabbed or like shot or, you know, any of those things, and the fact that he keeps getting up and coming at you, like, I kind of get that he's obviously the personification of evil, and evil just keeps coming, right? Like, it never stops. But I think it would have been more effective for me is if they had, instead of, like, stabbing him or getting him in the eye or whatever, and him just continuing to come at you like nothing's really happened, it would have been scarier to me as if they had been able to just find ways to narrowly escape rather than seemingly injure him in a way that would keep anybody else from moving
But that's the part that's the campfire story, right? That's the part that's the horror film, yeah. Is that he's supernatural because of the exchange. It really was the boogeyman. As a matter of fact, it was, right?
Right.
Is like it right. Does, that's where it pulls the rug out from underneath you, is this sense of you're going through this film thinking to yourself, Just a guy. I mean, like, you would go into any situation, a do or die situation, thinking, okay, it's me against him or me against her or what have you. This is a human being. I'm going to fight for my life. I'm going to be able to get out of this. I'm going to fight until nobody's fighting anymore. And you do what you think you need to do to win. And, right. You know, he's like the Terminator in that sense, right? Now, how or why? And that's where the horror aspect of it comes in. And that's why the ending is so creepy is, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. He should be dead. There's no way, there's no way, right. A human being's taken 6 45 slugs, you know, or 44 slugs. Sorry, that was a revolver. But like, or, you know, even if Loomis misses with the first shot, he takes 5 shots, you know, center mass after being stabbed in the eye and the neck, and you think to yourself, well, there's no way a human
falls
being
on the ground on his back and he should be dead. Yeah.
There's no way a human being can survive that. He must not be a human being. This has just become a supernatural story.
And I think that you just keyed on in on the thing that is not done well enough in the film was to give that kind of spin to it to really make it work for me. Like, I see where there are pieces for that in the movie, especially with the conversations you have with Loomis and the sheriff. You know, I get that there's some of that. And, of course, you know, obviously with the little boy and talking about the boogeyman, this whole thing, you know, I get all of that. It just, I would say for me, it just didn't work the way that it's supposed to. And for me, the technical aspects of the film are what give it a certain level. The rest of the movie, I find it failed in its attempt.
What would have made it work? How would that have made it work? Because that's basically the big reveal at the end, is he should be dying. Why isn't he dying?
Right.
So what makes that work?
I think what makes it work for me, if you could make this work, is I think Loomis is good. I think that the rest of the acting in the movie is subpar. I hate to say, I just don't think it's very good. I honestly, and I know you really like it, but I think that the music hurts the movie rather than helps the movie, because it keeps choreographing and telegraphing all the like times you're supposed to be scared, but in a really cliched way, not in a way that really helps me, where I think it would have been much more helpful to have the music not use the same theme every single time you're supposed to, quote unquote, be scared or have that moment. The way that it's structured, the way that he's using it, it actually hurt the movie rather than helped me. And it gave me that, like, this is funny because it seems so corny, instead of like, oh, this is scary. And that's the difference in our experiences, because I know that for you, it is something that really works. And so, but just for me watching the film, it felt more like a cliche of a movie than it felt like a movie. And maybe that's because you said it. Maybe some people built it up way too much and it just couldn't live up to the hype for me.
I can honestly say, with no hint of irony, you are the literal first person I've ever encountered that didn't have positive things to say about the score. And that
I'm unique.
I mean, it is what it is, but I mean, it's like, it's
in a bad way, but okay.
No. Well, you know, it is what it is. I'm not offering it as a criticism of you. I'm just saying, like, it's one of those things where I legitimately have never run across that specific criticism before. And so in a sense, that's one of the most disorienting critiques that you have, because it's like, you know, I can even say that, if I go full on detached, like, you know, I leave all the lights on and I'm just watching it just because sort of thing. And this is a film that is nothing like It's a Wonderful Life, except in one regard, in that I'm very measured with how many times I watch it, because I know that there is a fuse of how long it's going to be effective. And if I were to watch this film, you know, once every month, it's going to follow. It's going to eventually. No film was ever meant to be watched that many times. And a suspense film in specific, or something that's supposed to have a specific emotional impact, you know, you need to preserve that sort of experience about it. But, it, you know, in terms of the music, if I want to, like, totally detach myself and be like, well, that babysitter's not getting, you know, paid that night. She left my kid at home to go check on her friends, or who cares if her friends are dead? You know, that sort of thing.
Yep.
Like, that's still projecting, you know, a little bit too much of, you know, all of the different baggage I'm going to bring into it. You know, I mean, the thing is, I think that there are so much about this that works and that makes it, you know, a go-to classic for so many. It's just, it's interesting to me because the second one, Halloween 2 is the one that over time, each time I've watched it, it's lost a considerable amount of esteem from me. It's gone from it's just as good as the original to I really like it to it's pretty cool to it's better than average. Like, it's literally followed that trajectory, whereas this one has never followed that trajectory. This one has always, even when I've been able to divorce the scary monster aspect of it as an exercise in watching filmmaking, it's still, I could turn the sound off and have it playing while I'm working on the computer and just watch the imagery, and it's so well-paced and well-shot that I can't, you know, like I just think it's an achievement. I mean, you know, from that aspect.
Yeah, and I think maybe it would have worked better as a silent film, because I think a lot of the things that don't work for me have to do with things like I said, the acting and the music and all that, which I don't have a problem with. The other part aspect that you mentioned, which is I think that the you know, the DP work here with the lighting and everything, I think you're right, is actually really good. The way that they use shadow is really effective. That kind of stuff, I think, really works. Even just the camera movements and everything, the fact that you're using the Steadicam for the first time, really like this. You know, it's a very new technology, and so they're really utilizing that, and he's showing all the different ways that you can do the shots. And like I said earlier, with the aspect of having a lot of close-ups so that it gives you that you can't see what else is happening, so you're waiting any moment for something to happen because you can't see it as the audience, you know, because it feels like you don't have that peripheral vision. All that stuff I think is really good. It's just something about the rest of the movie. It doesn't come together for me as a horror film. And part of that is just that I was never scared. And so in that, it's a failure as a horror film, whereas I can recognize some of the ways in which, you know, Carpenter created some things that would then, you know, go on to be hallmarks of what we consider to be the modern horror film.
See, I find it interesting, you know, in the sense that I think this is just, you know, in so many regards, unassailably classic. But at the same time, I am completely aware of the fact that Carpenter feels trapped by its success, or may have, because there are other films, other horror films that he's done that are even better than this. Like his remake of The Thing is absolutely stellar. And you know, he even did The Fog, and he did, like, the guy knows how to manipulate an audience and set certain things up. And in, like, the one thing is that in terms of the scares, you know, this film doesn't really scare me anymore. It thrills me because, you know, I know all of the moments that are coming. I have this memorized probably almost as well as any Star Wars film. I know the shots. I know the pacing. I purposely go without watching it to preserve as much of, you know, every rewatch as I can. But I still know it very well. So I think that the testament more, and I would be interested to see your opinion, like if you were to rewatch it in a year, is to divorce it from the expectation of being frightening, and just looking at it from a strictly scholarly film perspective, if you will, if that might up your opinion of it.
Well, and I think, you know, as we've talked, you know, it's that scholarliness that I'm respecting. It's just the rest of it that I don't. And it's just because the rest of what the film is actually going for as a movie, its reason for existing, isn't doing what it's supposed to do for me. And so, like, there's the technical aspects, the filmmaking aspects that I really get and I actually appreciated and thought were great. I'd say another thing that doesn't, you know, work for me on top of it is that there were too many times I couldn't understand why certain characters were doing things that just seemed silly, like
dumb,
you know, and
hormonally driven teenagers do things. I was 17 and I did idiot stuff left and right. So
yeah,
you know.
I mean, and I mean that part I get, but you know, even if it, and we talked a little bit before the show, like even the part of like just being in a place and not turning on the lights, you know, like you know, that kind of thing. It's like it seems so counterintuitive to what you're doing, just from anybody's personal experience. The first thing you do when you walk into a room that's dark, you try to turn on the lights,
and
you know, and like
that's
so,
and people did, but like in terms of other things, what I'm intrigued about is barometer wise. I know you say you don't like horror, but have you seen The Shining? Right,
I haven't seen The Shining. I think the only real other I'm thinking of, like, I've seen Psycho,
mm-hmm.
I've seen Alien,
okay.
Aliens, you know, I've seen. This now, you know, I'd seen something like A Quiet Place.
So
I don't have a lot of experience with.
Well, the thing is, it's just that I want to get sort of a. I think it would be interesting to get a barometer, because everybody falls on the scale in a certain way, right? And so, you know, you have Alien, and did you find that to be thrilling or frightening?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, Alien. And Aliens work better than this,
okay.
In that sense, like the thrilling aspect, like a Quiet Place definitely worked better with that suspense and that those kind of moments, like they did what they were supposed to do.
Well, I mean, sound design in A Quiet Place was like next level.
It's insane. So.
So you haven't seen other horror films of the era, like The Shining. You haven't seen The Exorcist?
Like, and I think because specifically the things that I have seen from The Shining, I know myself personally, and I think I would not, there wouldn't be any enjoyment there. It would just be horror in a way that I don't personally want.
Okay.
And that's just my personality. And so you know, when, again, like when we talked about doing this,
right.
You said this was much more Hitchcockian, and I was like, oh, okay, I mean, that's something I enjoy, because I enjoy the Hitchcock thriller, suspense, all that. I've seen a lot of his movies, and I really enjoy what he does.
I would really be interested just to get it, sort of get a sense of the scale to try to convince you to watch The Shining, because that's actually a horror film. No, seriously, that's actually a horror film that I hated for years. I took every chance. Somebody would bring up The Shining, I'd be like, that movie sucks. Like, I didn't like it whatsoever. And I it was actually mutual acquaintances of ours. I was on a show with Sean Eastridge and Tristan Riddell, and I rewatched The Shining for the first time in years. And I mean years, like more than 10 years, probably even more than that. And, wow, yeah, it was probably like 20 years by then. Anyway, and I loved it. I was like, wow, I get it. I know why this movie rocks. And so I'm always curious as to where people fall on the scale, because the 70s were a great time for horror. And what's really interesting is the 70s is when there's sort of that, you know, auteur school of filmmaker explodes. And so we got a lot of really great horror. And the 80s is, I mean, you know, if this is anything that's like sort of a cultural trajectory sort of thing, the 80s is when it all became commoditized, right? Including this series. And so, like, it's really sort of fascinating to look at it. I would want to get select ones, not, you know, not the more, I would almost say that this is the one, if you want to call it a slasher film, that approaches the art house school, right? Everything that follows after this is the more derivative gristmill stuff. And this, I think, carries a lot of weight because it feels much more like it belongs to a Friedkin or a Polanski or a Kubrick school not putting them all on a level playing field, but I'm saying it belongs much more to those horror filmmakers than it does to the ones that came after. So, you know.
You heard it here, folks, first. I'm going to wake up one night, I'm going to walk out my door, and in my hallway there are going to be two little girls going, come and play with us.
Hey.
John Mills wants you to watch The Shining.
No, it's going to be me in a Michael Myers mask with a baseball bat saying, what did you say about that movie? Michael Myers talks now.
Oh, that actually might be scarier than the movie. So,
I
what's been fascinating about this whole thing, though, for me was just, you know, it's always interesting to go in and watch a movie that, you know, you haven't seen, that so many other people have seen, that have spent their lifetimes, you know, loving and liking and all those kind of things, and just having a different reaction. And for me, I can honestly say it's just my honest reaction. I didn't go in with any preconceptions other than I don't generally like horror, but with the way that it had been described, I thought that I maybe could like it. And especially since I had just had the experience with this year with A Quiet Place and being like, I don't like horror movies, but this looks... there's something about this that just looks... And I loved it. It's one of my favorite films of this year. So, you know, I definitely went in this with a completely open mind to thinking I could actually like the film. So, and it's not as though I don't... Like, I don't dislike this movie, and it's not something where it's like, oh, I hate that movie, that's stupid. It's just, it's a mixed thing. Like, there's some things that I really thought I really enjoyed and were well done, and I liked what he did, and then there were the other parts of the film that just didn't work for me, and so it just creates that more of a mixed emotion than kind of one fully on one side or the other.
Yeah, I get that. I get what you're saying. I can say, though, now that we've yanked off the Band-Aid and we've inched you closer to watching other horror films, you know, I'll borrow a line from The Simpsons, you know, you're never going to get desensitized to the violence if you don't watch it. So I hope to help you embark on a journey. I'll start giving you more and more things. And eventually, you know, you'll be a fan of modern horror films, too. You know, like Saw.
It's just like, you know. Poor little old Ralph. Daddy, I'm so scared I can't even pee my pants. Yeah. Don't worry, son. Just settle down.
It'll come. It'll come. Yeah. Hey, you know, it'll be... I think maybe now I would put out a call to any listener of the 602 Club, this episode in specific. Let's start putting pressure on Matt to watch The Shining. Let's get him to watch The Shining. Tell him you want him to cover it on the show.
Just great. But I mean, I think that this has been so fun because I loved, you know, you're such a fan and like, your passion for it is so clear. And I'm really glad that I did this just because, you know, it's one of those things, again, it becomes, you know, for both you and I, we love movies, you know, and so to see a movie that other people have really loved and just to say at this point, yeah, I've seen that, you know, and, I guess if I put a rating on this, you know, I'd say it's like, for me, it's 3 out of 5 because I really appreciate the technical aspects of the film. And I really do think that Carpenter had a lot of good things filmmaking wise that I really enjoyed in this movie. And I could see him kind of trying to do something in a way that was different. And I can understand specifically, even just in the time period, you know, 78, when this comes out, this does feel like something new at that point. You know, it feels like something very different than people have seen before in a lot of ways. But like you said, it does have those hallmarks of some of the things that like a Hitchcock would do. And so I really appreciated that. And I can see then why it becomes a kind of a benchmark that other people, you know, like you said, take and they commoditize and they ruin it for a while until people kind of come back and find a way to bring the horror genre back to more of its roots than just, oh, well, we just need more blood and guts and people screaming and ooh and ah, and everybody's running,
you know,
and screaming.
A parallel track you could easily say is with, you know, Star Wars comes out in 77, creates a big splash, and then you watch some of the stuff that came out afterward and you're like, whoa. Did they watch the movie and learn anything? You know, like it happens. You know, success breeds imitation.
Do you like, is there a way for you to rate this film at all?
Yeah. No, I can honestly throw it a 4.5 to 5, probably a 5, just because of its impact on the industry and spinning off a subgenre. You know, any limitations that I see in it that I ding it for, I recognize as limitations of its budget. And so I'm not.
Yes, you can definitely tell that. I mean, I think it would be great to go back in time almost and like give him more money just to see what he would do with it. Would it help the film or would it hurt the film? I think that would be gosh, if I had a TARDIS, I'd go back in time and do that.
You know, I think honestly that Carpenter is a guy who's much more comfortable in limited financial, you know, restricted financially. I think that he's a really clever, innovative filmmaker earlier in his career and able to stretch his dollar really far. When you see him start to get bigger budgets post The Thing or Big Trouble in Little China, then you start to, like, when you get to Escape from LA, like when you get into that era, you know, like you start to see maybe he should have stayed with lower budgets. But you know, overall, I think that, you know, again, anything I see as a flub or a misstep is budgetarily, you know, related.
Again, it's so fun to just get to do this. This is one of the things I love about the 602 Club. And in many ways, I feel like almost like we did a kind of like a Missing Frames. We just mentioned, right? Sean Eastridge, who was just on with doing the X-Men franchise with me as we're trying to work up to Dark Phoenix, which got pushed back. But yeah, you can listen to our Days of Future Past episode, which is the past episode from this.
It's a good one.
So yeah. So, but yeah, in fact, check out Sean's show, because it's fun. And people do this kind of thing where somebody watches a movie that they've never seen before. They should have seen him at this point. So yeah, plug for my friend Sean. So it was kind of neat to be able to do this here, since I'd never seen it, and you convinced me because, well, this is how much I care about you as a friend. I watched a horror film.
Oh, stop. Oh, shucks.
But if anybody wants to catch up with us, of course, like I said, you know, hit us up all in the regular places with all the usual suspects over there on Twitter, at Trek FM, and then, of course, on Facebook, on the Babel Conference, all those places. I really want to say thank you to the associate producers here that we have through Patreon. We've got Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson, Daniel Noah, and Ryan Millette. All of them support this show through Patreon. Now, we are a very large network. If you've seen Trek FM on any of the places you get your podcasts, you see that we have so many shows coming out each every week. And because of that, the costs for running the network are quite high. So go over to patreon.com/trekfm. You can see how you can be a part of our team. We have some great contribution levels. But honestly, any little bit you can do every month helps us keep these high-quality shows coming to you ad-free every single week. So go to patreon.com/trekfm and sign up today. John, I mean, it is honestly just a joy. If it's funny because I feel like if we had combined this with the beginning, like I think we talked for about 40 minutes before we even started recording. So that's how much I love this guy. But let people know if they wanted to, like, I mean, because you're a huge Halloween fan. Halloween's coming up. Maybe they want to talk scary movies with you. Where can they find you?
Well, you can find me out there in the Twitterverse as Kessel Junkie, KESSELJUNKIE. Same moniker over on Letterboxd and Goodreads. And you can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And over on The Nerd Party, I'm co-host on a delightful, delightful Star Wars show of a different stripe called Aggressive Negotiations, which I co-host with somebody named, conveniently, Matt Rushing.
Which, I have to say, it is an absolute joy to be able to do that each and every week. It's just a lot of fun. In fact, as of the dropping of this show, we just talked about the soundtrack for Empire Strikes Back. So if you want to listen to us discuss that, please check it out. It's a lot of fun. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network doing Owlpost with Drea Kaufman, where we talk about Harry Potter. We're going one chapter at a time each and every week. I'm on Twitter at MattRushing02. I'm on Instagram under the same name. I'm on Letterboxd too, but it's MRushing02 there. You can also find me here on the network doing The Orb with Chris Jones, talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And then last but not least, you can find me on a show called Cinema Stories, where I talk about films through the lens of faith. And my friend Courtney and I actually did A Quiet Place over there, so I hope you'll check that out. But I want to thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now, you hear?